Welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'm Marianne Wagner, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington's College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. I'm speaking today with Jenny Atkinson, Executive Director of the Friday Harbor Whale Museum. Jenny has a lifelong interest in connecting people with nature and wildlife through photography. After vacationing in the San Juans for a dozen years, she moved to the islands in 2007 to run the Whale Museum. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
In the Pacific Northwest live the southern resident community of orcas, an endangered population of orca whales, sometimes known as killer whales, that have lived in these waters for millennia. The Whale Museum on San Juan Island in Washington is dedicated to promoting stewardship of these whales and the Salish Sea ecosystem through education and research. The Whale Museum is located in Friday Harbor and opened to the public in 1979 as the first museum in the country devoted to a species living in the wild. Jenny, tell us how the museum first came about, because that's fascinating.
It is. And I'm really honored to be a part of this institution. I obviously wasn't here at the beginning, but they started in 1976 when there was a need to figure out exactly how many killer whales we had in the West Coast as there were some management decisions being made. So the study that was started here, those researchers thought, you know, this would be a good idea to share this information with the public. So they found a location and went to work to develop a museum to simply tell the story of what they knew about the whales and more about their research and engage people in stewardship.
Well, could you give us a little background on the southern resident killer whales themselves and their current situation? They're certainly in the news a lot these past few years.
Yeah, so it depends on how you want to count them, but there are 75 known members in this current population. They are listed as endangered, and that always confuses people because we have three populations or different ecotypes of killer whales in this region. You have offshores, which tend to stay off the continental shelf. They're on the west coast of North America. You also have transients that frequent the inland waters of the Salish Sea, and transients are marine mammal eaters. So one of the things that's critical to know about orcas is they are not generalist in their diets like we are. They are specialist. So they will select an item that is going to be their family or their ecotype's food, and that's what they predate on. And so resident killer whales are fish eaters. We have two populations of resident orcas in this region, the northern resident community, which tends to stay up north of Vancouver Island in the Georgia Strait area, up in Haida Gwaii, but we also have the southern residents that we're focused on today. And of those 75 members, one of the things that they realized, and they did this through research by identifying that they were a genetically distinct population that warranted this endangered species status to develop additional protections to help them recover their numbers. And you do that through genetics, but also realizing that they have culture and they have a distinct language within their community. And as fascinating as it is with all these other killer whales in this region, they don't mix or mingle. They're a closed population. So they are never going to go out on a date with transients and come back home with a new family member. They only mix and mingle within the southern resident community. So back in the 60s and 70s, there was a huge interest in killer whales. They began to try to catch them for aquaria and public display. That was devastating to the southern residents. And the reason they focused on that group is because we see them so often from shore. They were really easy to track and catch. So they spent a lot of time catching them. A lot of the southern resident community members died, over 50. I think it was 55, 60 orcas died in that. They were after the smaller ones that would be easier to transport. But a lot of other killer whales were caught and died during the process. So it was devastating to this population from the get-go. After the aquaria capture era, so to speak, ended, they noticed that the southern residents still weren't recovering, that they were still a population that, yes, lost a couple of generations, but, you know, why aren't they starting to rebound? So when they developed enough criteria and data to say, yes, they're an endangered species, that then means your government has to act. If you identify an animal as an endangered species, you are then compelled to develop a recovery plan. You have to develop research and data that supports your recovery efforts. So they identified southern residents are a Chinook salmon population. They love salmon. They are following the forage rounds up and down the coast going as far south as Monterey in California and as far north as Southeast Alaska. And they'll travel the inland waters extensively following those fish runs. We love salmon too. It's the biggest bang for the buck. It's a delicious fish. And what's the biggest one? Chinook salmon. So then you start to look at our stocks on the West Coast, and all of our Chinook runs are in trouble. They're either threatened or endangered, and some of them are now extinct. So you have a big food problem. But these are also super urban whales. All of the places that I just mentioned, you can think of big cities that are in the range from San Francisco to Monterey to, sorry, not Monterey, Seattle and Vancouver and Victoria, et cetera, et cetera. They're in this very urban area where we use this area a lot to recreate and traffic and do commerce. So you have an urban issue that has two levels to it. One, you have a lot of toxics and contaminants in the water, and that's really deadly for an animal, particularly since most of these contaminants are known as lipophilic. They attach to fats. Whales need a really thick blubber layer. When they don't get enough to eat, they're going to burn the blubber layer that releases those contaminants into their system, and it depresses their immune system. But the next one that they really focus on a lot, and you've just heard a new ruling out from WDFW, is the presence of vessels. Vessels have the opportunity, I would say, and I don't mean that in a positive way, but to negatively impact whales, not just through their presence, because they could come on too fast and disturb an animal's behavior and change it, but they could also be too loud. Sound is super critical to killer whales. They need it to echolocate, to send signals out to find their food and map their underwater environment. They also use it to communicate with one another. So you need super quiet waters, but you also need limited emissions that when they surface to breathe, they're mammals like us, they've got to take that gulp of air. If vessels that are putting out emissions are too close, they're going to breathe that in. And that's going to be an additional factor on their systems. So from food and contaminants and vessels, those are three things that they identified as the key threats that we could work on as a human population to help them recover. There are other things like inbreeding and oil spills, disease outbreak that are less controllable and less manageable, but they're also things that are in the recovery plans. And you have recovery plans on both sides of the border because this is a transboundary region. So Canada is very active and very involved in this process along with the United States and Washington State.
Yeah, I want to ask you a little more about that later, but the Whale Museum is the very first museum of this kind anywhere. Is that correct?
That's my understanding too. Yeah, it was the first museum dedicated to a species living in the wild. And if you think about it, a lot of museums that focused on whales were focused on human activities like whaling. They didn't worry so much about, well, what's that animal doing out there in the ocean? And is it doing okay? And it's not doing okay. How do we help? That's what the Whale Museum's focused on.
Yeah, I think that is fairly unique. There really aren't any other museums dedicated to the orca whale, as far as we know, that also do research and outreach and education in the nature that we do.
So that's where it gets tricky, because there are some different museums that have sprung up in the last couple of decades that are focused on species living in the wild. Even the Whale Museum isn't exclusively focused on orcas. We look at other populations. Our key species is the orca, and we're looking at the ecosystem and all levels of it. But we also have a variety of whales that come through here that it would be really disingenuous to not tell people about humpbacks and gray whales, minke whales, all these other animals that use the inland waters. You do have others that are around the world that do have levels of research and focus on orcas. And we have others in the inland waters that also, like, for example, the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, where I think you're broadcasting that region, they have an exhibit on orcas and have a hydrophone there where you can listen to whales too. So there are other groups that have platforms that include orcas and research. So thank goodness we're not alone anymore.
When you mention research, what kind of research are you talking about?
Anything that we can think of that might help these whales. A big platform for us, which your listeners will love because it has to do with sound. As we run an acoustics program, we have a hydrophone based at Limekiln Point State Park. It streams on the internet, so 24/7, you can listen to the sounds of the sea. You'd never guess what our number one sound is that we hear, and I'll give you a second to see if you can guess it. No guesses? I'll bet you somebody out there was saying, it's the snapping shrimp, and they'd be absolutely right. But you can also hear killer whales when they go by. Transients have a different call than southern residents do. Southern residents have three dialects within their community language, and we can hear those differences when they go by. So just by listening, we often know which pod is going by, and you can log that as a sighting. So that contributes to another research platform that we have. But by listening to the underwater sound, you can characterize how that sound might be impacting the way a killer whale is living and recommend some changes. We can also watch where marine mammals like killer whales are using the inland waters. And by collecting those data points of all those sightings, which is our whale hotline, we can put that in a larger database that informs management decisions for things like foraging hotspots or key socialization areas. We run the Soundwatch Boater Education Program. That's an on-the-water program to not only help vessel operators understand best practices when operating around whales, but we're also collecting data on how many boats are on whales, what the behaviors are, what are the incidents, so to speak, so that we can inform regulations and guidelines to better create a better environment for where the killer whales are living. We run the Marine Mammal Stranding Network for San Juan County, and that's where we collect, pick up live and deceased marine mammals that might have been injured or deceased. And then if it is deceased, then we can do an animal necropsy on it to figure out why it died. That's giving us information on emerging diseases and other things that might need some attention on systemic changes. But if it's something in good condition that we can take to rehabilitation or put it in a more secluded area to give it a better chance, we do that as well.
Tell me, what is the whale hotline?
So the whale hotline, thank you for asking. The whale hotline is an 800 number that folks throughout the region can call in their sightings of any marine mammal. We want to know about any marine mammals that you're seeing. We want to know where it is, what it's doing, what behaviors you observed, how many animals you saw. We put that in we have a couple of different databases where we collect this information. Because we're not just interested in orca whales. We also really want to know what harbor seals and other pinnipeds are doing. You can email that information to hotline@whalemuseum.org. We have some of that information on our website. So along with the hydrophone, where you can also indicate when you're hearing something really important that you want us to make sure that we grab a recording of to analyze later, the hotline is a huge citizen science project that we rely on people just like your listeners to share with us what they're hearing and seeing.
That's fantastic. And back to the Limekiln Sea Sound Remote Sensing Network. That's what you call your hydrophone. Is that the hydrophone means underwater, and that's all happening underwater.
Yep. A hydrophone is an underwater listening device. So the one that we have at Limekiln is about 20 feet out because the bathymetry there is very dynamic. Within about 30 feet of shore, it drops to 960 feet, and I don't have a cable that long. So we run it just shortly out from Limekiln, but it's far enough that it's going to pick up all the sounds, you know, probably in a 10-mile radius, depending on what the underwater bathymetry is doing.
That's fantastic, 10 miles. And I was on your website, and you can actually click on links to hear some of this audio. Isn't that right? I mean, I think I was listening to the sound of orca crunching on fish bones. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. That's one that was actually recorded by Marla Holt and some scientists through NOAA when they did a DTAG study, which was a suction cup hydrophone that was attached to the whale to pick up information because we wanted to know received levels of noise by the whales. So NOAA, National Marine Fisheries Service, did that. The cool thing for you, Marianne, and your listeners that you might want to know is we also edit a live webcam. So if you hear the orcas going by, if you jump to our YouTube channel for the Whale Museum, you can click on the link there and you can watch and listen at the same time.
Fantastic. I could do that all afternoon.
Yeah.
That's great. If you're just joining us, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. And I am Marianne Wagner, today's host of Coastal Cafe. And we're speaking with Jenny Atkinson of the Whale Museum. So Jenny, I also wanted to ask, your museum doesn't only do research and have displays, but you also promote stewardship. Why is this important to the museum?
So when you're trying to recover an endangered species or any aspect of your ecosystem, you need everybody to buy in. You know, they talk about, well, what difference can one person make? What does it matter if I drop my mask on the ground? I'm just one person. When we think about the Salish Sea as a watershed, collectively, we can make a huge impact. There are over 8 million people that live in this region, and that equates to more than 100,000 people per whale in the Southern Resident Community. If we all take this collective action to help restore this ecosystem, to help recover this population, think of the positive impact we could make. The changes would be phenomenal if we all bought into stewardship. So the Whale Museum believes firmly that if you provide the information and the education to people, this is a charismatic megafauna, the orca, and people are so inspired by just sitting and watching or listening to an orca breathe. And if you see one breach, people usually lose their minds and they go crazy, but they are immediately connected to this orca. And when you find out that it's endangered, you want to help it recover. So the best way to do that is to give them all the information of where they can help, how they can help, but also understanding that globally, all of our ecosystems connect. So you might come to the Salish Sea for a vacation and go back home to Wisconsin or Tasmania. Our ecosystems are still going to connect. And the changes that you make to improve your local ecosystem will ripple across the planet. And collectively, we can have a huge impact. But we need everybody past, you know, regulating agencies and nonprofits. You need individuals to stand up and say, this is a planet I care about. This is a species I care about, and I want to help, and I'm going to do something.
And you also work with recreational boaters to educate them about the whales via your Soundwatch Boater Education Program. Is that right? What topics do you cover, though?
That's right. So Soundwatch is the probably, we have a partner in Canada called Strait Watch. They are the biggest message carriers for the Be Whalewise program. You can find all of that information on our companion website, bewhalewise.org. That is a transboundary partnership that you can find in Canada and the United States. What are the guidelines? What are the regulations? Those shift based on the needs of the ecosystem and the orcas. You might see different fishing areas closed off. You might see different rules put into place if you have animals under particular stress or pressure. And what Soundwatch is out there doing is making sure that recreational vessels, as they come onto a scene or before they get there, understand that these are whale waters and we're recreating in their living room. And it's our responsibility to make sure we're doing that in a way that minimizes any impacts for the best prospect for whales to thrive.
I'm somewhat familiar with the Be Whalewise program. And so let's talk a little more about that. And as you mentioned, it is a international partnership, and you at the museum are all very much important partners on the Washington State side. Tell me a little bit more about the work you're doing specifically with Be Whalewise.
Sure. Be Whalewise was also something that was started by the Whale Museum through our Soundwatch program a long time ago, is that we realized, I think it was around 95, the Soundwatch team realized that recreational and commercial whale watching was a growing industry, that once we started to love these whales and realize they were not a danger to humans, they were really fun to watch and we wanted to see them. But you also needed to help people understand best practices because these whales are just living their lives. And one of the studies that has come out is in the presence of vessels, female orcas stop foraging and they start traveling. And the last thing you want to do with a population that is already under food pressures is to reduce its number of times that it's foraging or its possibilities for catching a fish. So developing these guidelines, which Be Whalewise is called that because, again, you're using the charismatic megafauna as the attention getter, but they were marine mammal guidelines. They were best practices for when you're paddling a kayak near a sea lion a harbor seal haul out. Is, you know, how are you going to do this in a way that you get to still see this animal, but you don't disturb its behavior? Resting time is important. Foraging time is important. Socializing time is important. And it's important for us to be aware of that and share what we know so that everybody can have the same information and operate in that way. And what I firmly believe, the Whale Museum firmly believes, is everybody wants to do the right thing. Nobody is out there intentionally trying to interrupt anybody's behavior. But we do stuff by accident all the time. And if you don't have the information, how can you know that, you know, by paddling this way or walking, you know, maybe paddling inshore of a whale, that that you're disturbing its behavior kind of a thing. So that's what we're trying to do, is help people understand best practices.
For recreational boaters, the general rule, and correct me if I'm wrong, is to stay at least 400 yards away. Is that accurate?
There's a diagram on our site, and it gets a little tricky because you have to, think about, they always talk about the path of a whale, but whales are super dynamic in their swim style. And a whale might be heading north, but a fish go by and all of a sudden their path is to the west because they're going to turn. So really, what I would recommend folks do is they go to the Be Whale Wise website, and depending on where they're boating, because we're only 6 miles from Canada, it's not very far to that dotted line, which, by the way, whales don't understand international boundaries, and they might go back and forth across them the entire time you're watching. It's also changed a little bit right now because of the new ruling from WDFW. There's a half nautical mile that's in place right now around some whales that are under particular pressure. So I would really ask folks to get themselves educated before they go out on the water every time, because it's a fluid situation and it's very dynamic right now.
So go to the Be Whale Wise website.
Yeah, 400 is a good indicator anyways, because I cannot tell you how quickly 400 can be 200 when you're a whale that can swim 35 miles an hour. So understanding those guidelines and what are the regulations helps you be a better vessel operator. And vessels are anything from, kayaks to motorized vessels.
The Be Whale Wise website, I've noticed, says to report what you see. So do people report in, and what are they reporting?
The cool thing about this partnership is Soundwatch is an education program. We are not enforcement. We are out there to help people get the information to make the best decisions when they're out there, to avoid incidents, to avoid being contacted by enforcement to say, did you know you were parked in the path? Did you know that you were speeding? Those kinds of things. So where it says to report that on the website, that goes directly to the enforcement agencies. Those are not things that come to us as the Whale Museum, because that's not our role. So depending on whether or not they're reporting a Canadian incident or a U.S. incident, it would go to the enforcement officers. But the kinds of things that, lots of folks would share with us, if you're standing next to somebody on shore, if you're with them on a boat or water, people talk, people share anyways, you'll see them on social media sites. But people are really concerned when they see vessels moving too fast, coming into a group of whales and seeming unaware. We have another program that was pioneered in BC waters and has been picked up in Washington waters. That's called the whale flag, the whale warning flag. So vessels and land-based people are supposed to raise this flag when they can see whales. And that it kind of operates like a diver down flag. It gives you the idea that I need to slow down and start looking, because there could be a whale. In Canada, they say, see a blow, go slow. So as soon as you see that, you raise this flag to let folks know that there are whales in the area and they need to modify their behavior to prevent any ship strikes. So going too fast, being in the path, if too close, people are always concerned about when they see whales change their behavior.
I've been to a couple of festivals and fairs lately around the sound, and I noticed a Be Whale Wise and the museum has a booth, and you're handing out those flags for free. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yep. San Juan County Marine Resource Council is the head of that program, and they've gotten grants and funding to make that available. When we go to boat shows and different education, like our doc talks, we want to make sure that people have that information.
Well, thank you. And when you walk through the museum itself, what will you see?
We have two levels, and you see everything from, understanding the connection in the ecosystem from the seafloor to the sea sky, but it's also from white cap to white cap, the sea to the mountains. You're going to see information on different whales, a lot of stuff on killer whales, particularly orcas. We have a genealogy chart that shows how all the whales are related. You can see little pictures of them. We have information on, babies and their names, all these different stories. There's movies. We've even have a phone booth where you can call a whale. It's the first and last phone booth in Friday Harbor. It's a recorded message, so don't think the whale's going to, ask for your number. But we have lots of stuff on acoustics. We have a brain cases where you can compare the size of your brain to other critters. lots of different stuff, but it's an amazing collection. And we are open year round every day. So there's only a couple of days out of the year that we close, and those are posted on our website.
The museum also offers educational classes about whales and all kinds of other subjects on the Salish Sea. So what are some of the classes you offer, and can you sign up for classes year round?
Yeah, thanks for asking. One of the interesting things that came out of the pandemic is a lot of us, most of us, got very familiar with virtual experiences and developed virtual programming. So the Whale Museum hosts a variety of talks and lectures. Right now, we're in the middle of our summer science lecture series. We have one coming up on basking sharks. We have another one on the Salish Sea Marine Survival Project. These kinds of things, those are free. They're open to the public. We advertise them on our events page on the Whale Museum. It's a Zoom link, so you can watch them from anywhere. But we also host things like the Marine Naturalist Training Program, which is an in-depth experience to learn about the entire ecosystem from geology to killer whales. And that one is also virtual this summer. It's advertised on our website for 6 classes. Usually the class size is about 50 people when we do a virtual experience. When we have that in person, you have to keep it to the size of the small bus on San Juan Island. So it's back to 24 people. But things like the gear up and gear down workshops for marine naturalists in the spring and the fall, of constantly trying to provide information to give people more education, more information, more ways to connect on a variety of aspects in the Salish Sea ecosystem. And just if folks in on the call aren't clear, the Salish Sea is all the inland waters of the inland waters of British Columbia and Washington State. But all the place names that we've known all our lives, like Puget Sound and Strait of Georgia and Rosario Strait, Harrow Strait, Strait of Juan de Fuca, those all hold. But you have this umbrella name, the Salish Sea, that helps us look at this as an integrated and connected ecosystem and to think of it more holistically when we try to work in it to do recovery efforts.
Well, thank you, Jenny. Any last message that you want our listeners to take away with them?
You know, I think I want to first thank you for hosting this conversation and for caring about this. And I also want to thank your listeners for tuning in. I believe that everybody cares. And what I want everybody to know is that collectively we can make a huge difference and it can be super positive. And I invite you, if you are not already helping recover our ecosystem and getting to know these whales, I invite you to join us.
Thank you, Jenny, for giving us an insider view of the unique work and important education that the Whale Museum conducts. To learn more about the Whale Museum on San Juan Island in Washington State, go to thewhalemuseum.org. This is Marianne Wagner, and you've been listening to Coastal Cafe, a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the UW College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical expertise, and education that support the conservation of our ocean and coastlines. I'd like to thank our station manager, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. And as always, a special shout out to the band Kooeaks for sharing their music with us at the open and closing of this program. And thank you for listening. Have a good day. Ha, to wasi bu, ha.